Hello, everyone. You're listening to Quasi-Indefatigable Zettelist. I'm Jay Demro, and it's been a couple of weeks since the last MP3 file. Time came. Got to do one again. I want to talk for a minute about not getting too weird about being a realist. And I have a real tendency to do this myself, you know? When I was a kid, I read a lot of magazines, and a lot of magazines I read, there was a man called Don Lancaster. I liked old Don Lancaster because he did cool stuff. Publishing on demand. He was a real kind of electronics guru type guy. He was an engineer, but he was kind of an independent person. He had gotten pretty much into publishing. And he didn't work for a company anymore. He had gone independent. I like that. So I used to love reading his articles. A lot of people did. A lot of people that were like me enjoyed them. Well, things changed. A whole lot of the electronics magazines from my childhood, from my young adulthood, have pretty much just disappeared. They're not there anymore. The whole computer electronic hobbyist thing has just kind of almost dried up and blown away. For a few reasons. The biggest reason is computers and the relative ease with which you can just get a computer and configure it to behave however you want to make something happen. Just like me, here I am, you know, 15, 20 years ago, if you would have wanted like an MP3 recorder, you would have actually built a little box, and that's what it did. It would record it, to some kind of chip, and then you would have that chip. Now, there's no point. I've got a laptop sitting in front of me, and I record my MP3s just plugging in a headset. To a computer. You know, it takes away all the fun. Any old dolt can do it. So, a whole bunch of dolts do. I could talk about how sad it was the bar's been lowered on access technology, but that's just the way things are. Don Lancaster, a lot of things that he has done, they are now obsolete. People don't buy a whole bunch of chips, integrated circuits, wire them together in a certain way to make things anymore. We don't do that. You know, the marketplace produces just about everything you would want that way. And unless you're after something that's really kind of esoteric that most people just don't want, there's not really a market for what you're doing. So, at least in the United States, I know that there's a few magazines over in Europe that still survive. Most of the ones in the United States have dried up and they're gone. I think maybe the only one that exists now is Nuts and Bolts. And, I don't even know if that one's still going anymore. Anyway, Don Lancaster was one of those people in there. He always had a great calm because he and I'm sorry, he was very smart. Still is. I'm not saying he's not very smart still. But, you know, he's gotten older and his interests are starting to change, and he's not after making all this money anymore. He's already made what money he has, and I guess he's retired now. Since, like, 2001, 2002. He still does a few things, but by and large, he doesn't do much publishing. And what happened with Don Lancaster is almost everything that he decided to go for because he thought they were going to be the next great thing, the thing that was going to keep him going. And you don't want to say this as to say, oh, well, he was truly stupid, and boy, anybody could have seen that coming, because they couldn't. He latched on to certain technologies that just didn't come together the way he thought they would have or should have or could have. His big thing, well, at least when I was doing, the first articles I ever read by Don Lancaster that I love was about the TV typewriter. It was probably the first hobbyist computer terminal. Of course, that's really silly because most computer people now would say, what the heck's a terminal? And you go, oh God, you guys are young. And, you know, a terminal was a serial device. It was actually kind of an update on a teletype machine. You know, it was the primary way that you communicated with a computer was to type information in. It was on a keyboard. It wasn't a very good keyboard, believe me. And the output would come out on this kind of printer thing, and they put them together, and it was called a teletype. For about 30 or 40 years, from probably like 1930 or World War II up until like the early 70s, every company worth its salt had what was called telex, and it was a way that they could. It was kind of like the earliest form of email, sort of. Not really. It was kind of a private telegraph system. They sent faxes that way. That was the early fax before they attached them to the phone lines. It was a way to transmit data back and forth usually between pretty large companies. And you'd use one of these machines, basically a typewriter and a printer put together. And the early microcomputer industry, this is how you talk to computers. You would type information onto this. It would usually have a paper tape on it. It would have this big reel of paper, a strip of paper. And you would type whatever you were doing, and it would punch out this paper strip with holes, and that was a cheap way of storing data. A lot of data got stored that way. If it was short stuff, and if you really didn't have the money for the big, huge magnetic disk storage, you know, the big cabinet ones, that a magnetic disk was a 14-inch platter, which you really have inside every computer that we have now, just in a reduced form, and it's not interchangeable like the old ones were. you know, just this amazing thing. Anyway, John Lancaster came out with the first telephone typewriter, television typewriter. And it was for hobbyists. You could take a couple of $100 worth of integrated circuits and a bunch of wire and some boards and some switches, and you could rig up this terminal, which took the place of a teletype. And what it did was it used your television screen to replace the typewriter part, which was great because then you didn't have to constantly feed this thing paper. You could see what results were displayed on the television screen. And it was great. People loved it. And I had studied this quite a bit. Now, I didn't get into these things until probably 79, 80. So this was all pretty antique. This stuff was already 6 or 7 years old. But if you wanted to build an inexpensive computer system, this was still basically how it was done. Is you would do it this way, if you wanted to hand make the thing. But this was also about the time when the Sinclair ZX80 was coming out, which was really, really cheap. There was basically a little TV typewriter type of thing made as inexpensive as you possibly can get it. And during the times when the actual terminal wasn't doing anything, because all TVs have what's called vertical rescan, it's hard to explain. Anyway, it's not really hard to explain it. I'm just going to take the time to do it. There's a time between screens that are painted on your television where the TV's getting ready to paint the new thing. It's those scan lines that it goes across really fast. Your screen is repainted 60 times a second. That's how it looks, at least on old analog TVs. If you got a new digital TV, it's handled completely differently. Anyway, the great part about the ZX80, even though people went, "Oh, this isn't a real computer, it's a toy," is that you could still do programming on it. It was like a computer that way. You could program in BASIC. It actually did the computer processing during that time when your TV would be not accepting video signal. It would be getting ready to paint the next screen, and the CPU it, the Z80 chip that was in it, would do its processing at that time. And computers are really quick, really fast. 60 hertz is really slow compared to the 3.5 megahertz, 1,000 hertz, that computer ran at, or could run at, the ZX80 and the ZX81. Neat little computers, honestly. You could do a lot of, I mean, you had a real computer there, you know. People said, "Oh, it's so slow and dinky and the memory on it, pathetic." At the time, it was marvelous. You could do a lot of stuff with it. You couldn't do what computers do now just because the memory storage just wasn't there. But It was a great way to learn about computers. I had a ZX81, still do. I still have one. It's in pieces because I had done some upgrades to it. I'd upgraded the memory myself. I wasn't following instructions of anybody else. I just knew about how to do it, so I did. And I put a new keyboard on it so that it had a little better keyboard, and it's still there, and it should work. There's not much to break down on a ZX81. I've got the plans to do a ZX97. This was something the guy came up with in 1997, which is kind of an update to it. And he's done some really cool stuff. I download the entire site. I'm going to burn CD-ROM so I can always have it in case he falls over dead or he's just not interested in putting it up on the web anymore. And anyway, I got off my original thing. Don Lancaster was this great guy. He was one of the guys that kind of started the personal computer industry. He was one of the guys that put together some of the basic understanding, the basic knowledge, and came up with the basic equipment. He was the first guy that came up and said, you know what, we can build a terminal really cheap to take the place of a piece of equipment that was really expensive and prone to lots of problems, and to make it easier for people to have computers. It lowered the bar. Now the bar is so low, everybody has computers, everybody uses them, to the point to where any dingbat can use it. It's kind of sad. But that's okay. That's where the market goes. I am a great fan of Don Lancaster. He was a great guy. A lot of people were. Over time, he got into something called PostScript, which is a computer language that was actually written to control printers. And PostScript was something that was originally first used by the printing industry, you know, those who run presses. And the first laser printers, the commercial grade ones, which came out before the personal grade ones, were these big monstrosities. And most of them, the language that you use to talk to that printer was PostScript. PostScript was a big Apple latched on to PostScript somewhere just before, I think, the Macintosh era. Their first laser printers that they put into schools and that they sold to kind of high-end, high-scale people, they were all PostScript printers. And PostScript was a great idea. And it got to the point to where it was a really excellent general-purpose computer language. It was never used that way. It never really got down to it. Even today, some of your best printers, the ones with the most capability, they are PostScript printers. Of course, now you don't have to have the PostScript. He was always big on having the PostScript built into the printer. You would actually have a hard drive inside your printer, and it would accept these print jobs, and then your computer could go off and do something else while the printer was running. And his first setup was to spend tons of money on a really nice printer that would cost probably $3,000-$4,000, which wasn't much back then. You know, most of your computers were costing a couple of thousand for the pathetic computers that they were. And he would use an Apple II. Now, for those of you who don't know an Apple II, it's why you're kind of screwed. He would use an Apple II to actually do his composition work, and then he would send it to this printer so that he could, you know. And then once it was at the printer, if your print job took 5 hours, that was fine because you still had your Apple II available to do this. And he used to pretty much do most of his work in raw PostScript. Most people don't do that anymore. You have another program. My personal favorite is Adobe PageMaker. That kind of gives you a WYSIWYG, and what you see is what you get interface, so that you can create your page, and then that would turn it into a PostScript file and send it to the printer. I've never had a PostScript printer myself. I've always used other things. With time, we've gotten multitasking computers where the setup Don had isn't terribly necessary anymore. Because your computer can handle the entire print job and do other things at the same time. So the point that he had made back in the old days is now kind of moot. And that's what's happened to a lot of what Don did originally, was that he made, what was it, the cool stuff that he had come up with, ways to make things happen that you normally wouldn't think were very important, or things that you would normally think that were technologically beyond you, that you had to go to a big business. And they had huge, expensive, nasty equipment to do that. He had found a way with pretty much stock parts and with a little bit of intelligence, which is always what hackers do. They are able to reposition things in a way that nobody else had ever thought of when they do things to make it so that a small operation can look big. Or can do things a big operation can do, or can serve a niche market. That was a big thing for Don. Oh my gosh, time's nearly up. We're going to have to do a part two on this. The first thing out here is kind of a history of Don Lancaster and what he, at least my take on what he did. Pretty amazing guy in my book. The next time I'll finally get down to the thing where I talk about that it's important not to be, it might be a three-part, who knows, it might not be a good idea to be too realistic because I think it starts taking away your dreams. He became a real realist over time. Anyway, my name is Jay Nemro. You're listening to Quasi-Indefatigable Zenilith. Have a great day.